Welcome to the 212th episode of the Reading and Writing Podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Rutherford. Stay tuned for my interview with thriller author Shane Coon, author of The Intern's Handbook and Hostile Takeover. Stay tuned for the interview. Welcome back to the Reading and Writing Podcast. My guest today is Shane Coon, author of the thriller novel Hostile Takeover. Coon's first novel, The Intern's Handbook, received a lot of great critical praise and was a bestseller. Shane, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much for having me.
Great. Well, can you read the first two, two or three pages from your new novel, Hostile Takeover?
Yes, no problem. This is from chapter 4. Dearly beloved, we are gathered here to get today to join, I'm sorry, I never got your names. That's because we didn't give them to you, I said coldly. Come on, Padre, let's move it along, Alice said. Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to join this couple in holy matrimony. Our wedding was a relatively small affair. Like most professional killers, we had no family or friends of any kind, so the guest list was a snap. John, check. Alice, check. Non-denominational, guitar-playing ex-convict minister who didn't ask a lot of questions. Check. Smartly dressed hotel staffer poised to toss Juliet rose petals and pop a bottle of 1907 Heidsieck champagne, recovered from the Swedish freighter Jönköping, after it was sunk by a German U-boat in 1916, something old, upon completion of nuptials. Check. All weddings should be like ours was. The bride and groom, solitary as their cake-topper doppelgangers, grinning before Yahweh in bespoke couture. Even though we spared the guest list, we spared no expense. The ceremony took place in the Ty Warner penthouse at the Four Seasons in Manhattan. For the price of one night's lodging in that room, you could feed and clothe several villages in Myanmar for a full year. Alice looked stunning in her handmade jet black wedding gown, something new, that I had a goth seamstress fashion out of exotic military fabrics. It cost me a small fortune and nearly my pinky finger, but it was worth it. That dress made me want to cut my own heart out and bleed on the sacrificial stone to show my gratitude to the gods. And after all that, I couldn't wait to unceremoniously rip it off her. I was wearing a tuxedo I stole from a dead MI6 agent, possibly my best dress target, and a pair of Vietnam-era jungle combat boots I won in a card game before I killed a room full of Laotian flesh peddlers with a camp shovel. Alice wasn't into the boots, but I told her letting me wear them was the least she could do after she had tried several times in the last year to put a bullet in my head, but only managed to hit my heel. She one-upped me by wearing a pair of Alexander McQueen Titanic ballerina pumps she'd had fitted with a razor-sharp titanium stiletto heel that could lacerate Kevlar and punch through concrete. They were wickedly beautiful, and I couldn't help but wonder how they would look pointing at the ceiling. Do you take her to be your lawfully wedded wife? I do, Alice said. Seriously, I said, annoyed? It's not your turn. Why don't we try that again, the minister said. No, Alice glared. Don't ruin the moment, I said. I don't like the rest of those tired, played-out vows, Alice said. To having to hold in sickness and in health till death do us part? Those, I inquired casually. Yep, she snapped, strangling her exquisite saffron crocus bouquet. Fine, what do you suggest? There's a very rare bottle of champagne that has waited patiently at the bottom of the ocean off the coast of Finland for nearly 100 years for us to drink it, she began. We have actual kush fresh off the plane from Islamabad, and the Maine lobsters are going to kill each other if we don't kill them first. And let's not forget, I'm so horny I could fuck a mechanical bull. So with all of these more urgent matters, why do we need to go through this ritual nonsense? I do, I said. We're not there yet, the minister said, annoyed. Shh, Alice said, pressing her finger to his lips too hard and slightly cutting him with what I could see was a French manicured nail with a razor-sharp rose-gold edge, adding an instant upgrade to my shoe fantasy. In the interest of expediting the fulfillment of that fantasy, I kissed the bride. The minister scowled and lit a cigarette while we made out like high school prom dates. I now pronounce you man and wife. Hands everywhere, groping, outside voices. Okay, I'm out of here, the minister said. Congratulations, you two were made for each other. He took leave of us, along with the hotel staffers, and we took leave of our senses. Just think Bacchanal meets Masters and Johnson meets Penthouse Letters, and you pretty much got the picture. After several hours of marital consummation, we put our beautiful wedding clothes back on and had a smoke on the terrace. Promise me we'll have sex like that for the rest of our lives, no matter how old, gray, and foul-smelling we are, she said. No way, I said. Maybe if we were chimpanzees on some kind of experimental military drug. Outside of that, I'd be dead in 5 years if we kept up this pace. Maybe that's my fiendish plan, to fuck you to death. Okay, I promise. We both laughed, mainly because the irony of the situation was as thick as our Sylvia Weinstock wedding cake and twice as sweet. I married the love of my life and former nemesis. We had the most beautiful wedding two totally disconnected psychopaths could possibly have had. We enjoyed unspeakable pleasures, and then it was time for the pièce de résistance, my wedding present to Alice. I opened the doors to the foyer, yes, the suite was that big, and revealed a massive, beautifully wrapped box about the size of a coffin. What is it, she said, licking her lips. Open it and find out. She tore off the wrapping paper and lifted the lid off the box. Her jaw dropped. Holy shit, John. That's only the beginning. Excuse me, she said, incredulous. This is a two-part present. What's part two? Are you sure you're ready? I asked coyly. Don't make me shoot you in your other foot. I looked at my watch. 20 minutes and all will be revealed. Enough time for champagne. We popped the shipwrecked Heidsieck and toasted. It tasted like unbridled optimism, with a gunpowder nose and a burnt lemon and kerosene finish. After we practically sucked the last drop out of the bottle, we kissed, tasting victory on each other's malevolent lips. And that's it.
That's great. Well, if someone listening hasn't heard about Hostile Takeover yet, how would you describe your new novel?
You know, how I describe it, it seems to be evolving every day, but I think the way I am really liking to describe it now is I really feel like it's an explosive love story, you know, because like the more I sort of think about the process that went into writing it, what I really gravitated to was John and Alice and their relationship. And when you read the book, you'll see that the narrative really tracks with their relationship. You know, there's a lot of plot. There are a lot of plot elements that are there along the way that move the story along. But if you look at it, you'll see that the narrative is really driven by their love story. So that's what I would call it. I would call it an explosive love story.
Gotcha. Well, do you remember the original idea or impetus that led you to writing about John Lago, the protagonist of Hostile Takeover, in your first novel, The Intern's Handbook?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of a long story, but I'll try to make it as brief as I can. I mean, basically, for years, you know, I worked in, you know, film and television for many years. And for all of those years, including before that, I've always loved assassin stories. And I've seen, you know, most of the great assassin movies. And so I've been fairly obsessed with that genre and that type of character. So I was always motivated to write a great assassin character in the context of a great assassin story. But the problem was finding something unique. You know, that a lot of this is not an uncommon story to tell. There are many, many, you know, books and movies about the subject and these types of characters. But for me, it was important that it would be a completely original character. So I tried and failed many times to sort of kick something like this off in my career as a writer, and never really got anywhere until about, I think it was around just after like 2008 and the financial crises that we were all dealing with. I became obsessed. I use the word obsessed a lot. I became obsessed with corporate crime. And I think a lot of people did, you know, as in the movie business, everybody was, you know, trying to create television shows and movies about that subject. For me, it was interesting because as a person who loves movies and books about organized crime, it occurred to me that corporate crime is the most powerful and dangerous sort of cartel, if you will, in the world, because, you know, who else? The mafia isn't even capable of pillaging an entire retirement fund and then getting packaged out with a $40 million severance package. So Thinking about that, I really wanted to do, I was actually working on a television show that was about that. It was about corporate, you know, basically white collar, you know, people who decide to start this organized crime, family of their own, and they're not even mafia. So I was working on that, and, you know, as you're working on something like that with the crime, sort of organized crime paradigm, thinking about the different stratum of people involved in the organization, from the bosses all the way down to the minions. And I started thinking about the minions because, the interns themselves have always been kind of a funny thing to me. I've been an intern many times, and I always thought it was kind of a hilarious, weird position. So as I was thinking about this show, I thought, you know, what would the interns be doing, you know, in this kind of organized crime scenario? And, you know, I think the instinct for most anybody would be that they're the minions. They're the ones who are going around doing the dirty work. But I actually thought more about it, and I wanted to subvert that. I often like to do that within storytelling. So I basically wanted to empower them. I wanted to make them, you know, like, not what you think they are. I wanted to make them kind of people around the show. And that's when it clicked, that they could be assassins, because, you know, to me, within that kind of organized crime scenario, or just crime in general, I can't imagine a more powerful character than an assassin. I feel like assassins are very powerful for the same reason that I really like those characters, and that is because they don't live by any rules. You know, they don't have to. You know, the police are not a problem for them. You know, general society is not a problem for them. So that was where it all clicked, and I thought, wow, okay, that could be cool if interns were assassins. And then after that, it just kind of like really came together, because I started to think about, John, he came into my mind as the character, and at the time I pictured him as Joseph Gordon-Levitt, you know, and but he kind of just developed in my head. And that's kind of one way that I like to write, it's kind of like method acting. I just start kind of like living in a character and thinking about what they would be doing about a lot of different scenarios. And it just kind of expanded from there, because I felt like, you know, conceptually I had a great idea. And then working on John, I really did want him to be kind of a blank slate character who had to kind of invent his own life. And it just evolved from there. So that it's kind of a long story, but it's kind of the idea really comes out of, like, it's kind of a love child between my love of assassin stories and also, you know, the concept of interns and internships.
Right. So I know that you mentioned that you did work in film and TV. Did the Intern's Handbook start out as a script?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's, basically, it was kind of an interesting situation, because I started outlining it as a script, and at the time I was working on a project, because I've worked with a writing partner for years, and at the time we were working on a project, and it was extremely frustrating. I mean, it was like one of the most frustrating things I've ever done, not even just work-wise or creatively, just like in general in life. It was one of the most frustrating, time-wasting situations I've ever been in. And so I was really like, I was, at the time I was outlining interns, I was really down on the entertainment business, because I'd literally been like put through the ringer for this project, and many promises were made, and of course I stupidly believed them, even though after years I, you know, experienced them never coming true. But it was really a situation that seemed like something was going to happen. And in the end, it just fizzled. I mean, literally, like in one day, it fizzled out. So I was really down on that business, and I didn't, you know, I was having a hard time outlining interns, because I was thinking to myself, I don't want to just, you know, write this and then give it to someone and hope that they like it. And then they show it to someone that we all hope likes it, and they show it to another person that we all hope likes it. You know, like this whole weird, dysfunctional family tree that would have to sort of grow and come together, you know, for someone to want to actually make it into a movie. And I was, you know, I had sold scripts and I had sold pitches. And the idea, because I love this idea so much, the idea of just turning it over to someone, even if I was paid, and then having zero control over it, having it just kind of like sit on a shelf, which a lot of things have done or doing right now, I couldn't bear it. So that was when I decided to write it as a book. And it was kind of scary because I have written a book before, but it was years ago. It was like in when I was in film school, ironically, in the early 90s. And I've always written journals, and I've always, you know, worked on prose for years and years. But to actually sit down and write a novel was pretty daunting. But basically, like as soon as I got the courage to do it and sat down and did it, it was so fun and so enjoyable, as opposed to everything I'd ever done in the movie business, that I wrote it really quickly. I wrote it in like, I think I wrote the first draft in like 60 days, you know, because I was every night I was pounding away at this thing and having a great time. So yeah, that's kind of another long story, I guess.
Sure. and what was the process at that point? I mean, did you have a literary agent, or did you go to your film agent in terms of getting the first one published, The Intern's Handbook?
Yeah, what I did is I don't have an agent anymore, because I'm not a big believer in that for writers. You know, I think they're good for like packaging and things like agents and actors, mm-hmm. But I do have a manager, this guy, Brad Mendelsohn, at Circle of Confusion. And so I went to Brad, because I knew that he did a lot of work, you know, like in his business, especially because he works in television. You know, he did a lot of, you know, book acquisitions and options and things like that. Usually it was him. He was the one who was optioning authors' books.
Right.
But I called him and I said, hey, man, I want to write a book. And he said, cool, okay. So automatically, though, he said, you know, I've got the perfect person for you to talk to about this, this woman, Hannah Gordon. And he's done business with Hannah for years, and they're very close professionally. And, you know, she was in New York at the time. She was, you know, she would do a trip to the West Coast a couple times a year to present material to him for option, things like that. So I contacted, I ended up contacting her, and she's very nice and smart and professional and like just, you know, easygoing. And she just said, okay, you know, just write me a one pager, you know, sort of like outlining the concept and the character. And I did that immediately. I think I turned that around in like 6 hours or something like that. Cause I had all the material, you know, I just had to like distill it down. So I actually sent her, oddly enough, I sent her 2 1 pages because I had this other novel that I also wanted to do, and that one's more autobiographical. But she's like, I love both of these, you know. She's like, let's explore Intern's Handbook first, because the other one is, as I said, somewhat autobiographical, and it's a much more complicated. It's more of a dramatic nonfiction genre book.
Right.
So she's like, you know, okay, so to get you started, let's work on Intern, a less complicated affair. You know, it's very close to what you've been doing in certain in terms of narrative structure. And so I did an outline for her, and you know, she called me and she said, wow, that's like the most detailed outline I think an author has ever sent me. Because I sent her like this 20-page beat-by-beat outline, something that I had done for scripts, you know, like usually that people require that. She loved it and thought it was amazing. And so she said, let's do this thing. And that was, I think that was June. That was like, I think it was June of 2010. Yeah, don't quote me on dates.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm horrible with weights and measures, but yeah, so that was, yeah, it was early summer, and worked on the book all summer. And by end of August, we had a draft that we'd gone through and edited several times. And in September, that's when she took it out to to publishers. So the process was, you know, I guess all those years in the movie business did finally pay off, because it got me a connection with a great literary agent, a great book agent, and that's how it all kind of came together.
Got it. So what was the biggest difference you found between all those years of writing scripts and treatments and then sitting down and writing a novel?
The biggest difference, just on an emotional level, is enjoying writing versus hating writing. I mean, I'm a writer who, like, I'm compelled to write. I've been writing since I was 8 years old, and I always loved it when I was younger. You know, I'd write prose and poetry. I've written a lot of poetry, mainly because I never had time to do anything else. But over the years, that's what I enjoyed. And then I got into the movie business because my dad, you know, was like, "You're never going to make any damn money as a writer." And so I was like, "Oh, how can I make some money doing this?" And so the movie, and I love movies. So I thought, well, that's the perfect thing. You know, I can write for movies or TV, and then I can make my parents proud and all that stuff, you know? And so, but really, like, the movie business really made me hate writing, because, you know, the thing about art, no matter what it is the more people that are involved, the worse it gets. You know, it's like the art by committee thing. And the movie business is the pinnacle of that. So, like, you as a writer, you're at the bottom of the totem pole. I mean, literally, I think craft services is like one notch above you. You know, so no one cares about you. Even if you're one of these million-dollar, like, rewrite people, no one even knows those people's names. No one barely get any accolades or anything. But worse than that, in the creative process, they're really not considered at all, because, you know, film is a director's medium, period. You know, so basically, like, and also the you know, the working within film narrative is very structured and controlled, just format wise. You know, like, if you're trying to tell if you're not doing experimental film, if you're trying to tell, like, what would be something you'd see in a movie theater, there's a structure to that you need to adhere to some degree. But beyond that, the movie business, because it's become so conservative, they actually also put a layer of creative structure on it. So, like, heroes can only do this and that, and they can't do this, and they can never say this, and they can never actually do certain actions, because that Hollywood has their idea of what a hero is, or what a protagonist is. So it's wildly constraining. And once you think, okay, I've kind of figured this out, and you're doing it, then you start working with a committee of people who none of them agree, and art is, like, so incredibly subjective. So in the end, it becomes a total mess. You know, I don't see how any movies get made at all. it's funny, but also it's kind of not funny, because I literally could write a book about creative projects and what an incredible shit show they became, and how they started out as something great and just devolved into a total mess, you know? So that all speaks to, like, the enjoyment of the craft. And so I would say, just, you know, on a life level, on an emotional level, writing books, I love. I mean, like, I never thought I would say that I love to write again, but I love it so much. And it's not because I have, you know, like, total creative control and I'm some kind of, like, egomaniacal, you know, like, Napoleonic, you know, leader when it comes to that. But I do like to be able to express myself as freely as possible without a lot of interference from other people. And I love working with my editor, you know, because basically the difference with, like, you know, like, if you write a script and it's going around, it's doing the rounds with the committee, you know, they're basically changing everything you do without even asking you. Right. Book editors, they respect your work. You know, their motto, or their whole goal, their mandate, is to make sure that you are publishing the best expression of what you are trying to express, versus them trying to say, you know, I think it'd be better, instead of an assassin, he's a female photographer. You know, like, that's what the movie business is. Like, they all think, oh, that's not a big change. You know, what's wrong with that, you know? So, I don't know, like, it's all about, like, loving the craft again. It's like, and if people want to really get an idea of what I'm talking about with the movie business, they should read Goldman's book, Adventures in the Screen Trade, because it's the perfect, even though it's a bit dated because he talks about older movies, it's still all the same. It's still a perfect example of how that situation goes down, yeah, in the movie business. Yeah.
So are you planning to write more John Lago novels?
Yes, I'm planning to do that. What's unclear is whether, you know, is the publishing of those, because, I mean, basically, Simon & Schuster, you know, they're seeing how these do. You know, they're seeing how they're accepted, obviously, how well they sell, things like that. And they put, I'm very happy with the faith that they've put into them. I mean, I know from talking to a lot of the authors, you know, for them to greenlight a second book, with the first book barely even being out very long, took a lot of faith on their part, and I appreciate that. So in the end, the answer is I will not stop writing John Lago books. I'm hoping that we, you know, with Simon & Schuster, we can continue, you know, doing this. But I think if they were to determine that it isn't, you know, necessarily like a profitable venture for them, I think I would still continue doing it, because I really do love this character. I feel like I have a lot of scenarios. I know for a fact I've got at least six, you know, more books, you know, book concepts that I could start on tomorrow, you know. Mm-hmm. And also I'd like to do offshoots, you know, like a lot of people on the book tour this time around have said, you know, you really should write an Alice book. And I've thought about that before, but the more I hear people asking for it, the more I think it would be really cool. Because I do love that character, and you know, there isn't a lot of, in both books, there isn't a lot of information about her and her past. So I think it'd be really fun to delve into that. I think it's, for me, it's going to live on until I run out of ideas.
Right.
You know?
Right. Well, I wondered, you mentioned earlier about always liking assassins and the assassin genre. Are there films or books or authors that specifically inspired you when you were working on the two novels, Intern's Handbook and Hostile Takeover?
Yeah, I think if I'm going to, you know, for me, film is a far bigger influence when it comes to genre than books, because the way I consume books is totally different. You know, I read a lot of Chuck Palahniuk and Kurt Vonnegut. And, you know, I don't necessarily go for thrillers and genre books, you know, in that world. But for assassin stories, it's movies for me that have the most impact. And my favorites are The Professional and La Femme Nikita. And I have to throw The Day of the Jackal in there too, because I love the spectrum of the, if you take those three films, I love that spectrum that it offers, because you have The Day of the Jackal, which is I don't want to say typical, but it's like, it's a very real kind of like, okay, this is, and it's based on something real, you know? So it's like, it's a very real interpretation of what an assassin, how an assassin would operate.
Right.
You know, it's methodical, and there's nothing all that exciting about it. You know, if you see that movie, there are exciting moments, but it's very methodical, type of thing to watch, because in the real world, that's how it would have to be, you know? If you're going to kill Charles de Gaulle, you know, that's how an assassin would have to approach it. And so I love the realism of that particular film. And then you get into The Professional, where you're sort of like exiting realism a little bit, but you still are grounded to some extent. And also what I love about the character in that film is that he is the blank slate, you know, like you see those scenes where he's basically like got nothing in his apartment, and he's, you know, like in kind of invented himself, but he's got this one talent, which is like a very, you know, high level version of that talent. And I like I think what I really took away from The Professional is the assassin as ghost concept, which makes perfect sense to me, because, you know, like the thing about James Bond, obviously he's not an assassin, but you know, it's very difficult to be covert when you're going around telling everyone your name, you know, that kind of thing. So what I love about that character is that he says, you know, like when you're really good at this, you use a knife because no one can see you coming. So I think, you know, there are some crazy, definitely some, you know, stepping outside of realism in that movie. But at the same time, I think the character, the portrayal of the assassin is very grounded. But then you get into La Femme Nikita, and what I really liked, I mean, that just kind of like blew my mind, because I loved how, you know, like I love stories where quote unquote normal citizens become transformed into something like this. And it's an interesting way, the way Nikita becomes what she is. That's a very interesting process too, you know, like the drug addict, you know, drugstore cowboy, cowgirl, you know, type thing. To this assassin. But I love how, like, they're, you know, because she's a quote unquote normal person, you know, unlike those other two characters, she still has her emotions, you know, she still is that normal person emotionally. So you see what it does to her. You see, like, how it's just like, you know, like the scene where her boyfriend is out in the hotel room, she's in the bathroom, about ready to shoot someone with this incredibly bizarre, you know, rifle that was hidden under the sink or whatever, you know, and she's sobbing while she's doing it. You know, it's like, I love that because she's like, she's a real person, and she had a chance to become a real person and then became an assassin. So I think all of those, that to me, that represents the sort of spectrum of things, because I think all those movies, you know, have what I love about how the assassin is very powerful. It's like this kind of all-powerful person. But at the same time, there are levels of that. And Nikita, really, like, the first, like, the Professional and Day of the Jackal are what you'd expect of an assassin character, even though those are great films. But Nikita is totally unexpected. And that, I think that kind of opened the door for a lot of different types of movies and books that could explore that. So, It definitely was something for me too, because, you know, when I was thinking about John, I was thinking about Nikita quite a bit, and how, you know, that there are similarities there, at least in terms of them both having a somewhat emotional life and having, you know, in being in this profession and what it's done to them over time.
That's great. What's the status of the Intern's Handbook movie?
Currently, a couple of drafts of the script have been written, and they're looking for a director. And over the past 3 months, they've been... the studio and also Original Film, Neil Moritz's company, they've been interviewing directors. A lot of directors really want to do this movie. They, you know, and usually it's those who've read the book. And so they've been through this. It's kind of funny. It's like they've been through this kind of interview process where a lot of these directors, whose names I recognize, you know, they're actually kind of like doing little presentations in the office and things like that to try to get the gig. So that's pretty cool. But they've narrowed it down to two candidates. I'm not allowed to say who they are right now, unfortunately. Yep. I wish I could. But I can tell you that they're very accomplished filmmakers. And I know their work, and I think their work is excellent. And it would be great to have either of them do it. You know, it'd be very cool to have either of them do it. So basically, it's kind of like, I guess the decision is going to come down to the studio, and the studio and the producers are all debating which person to choose. So again, back to the committee. The committee is deciding on who will direct. But I've been told that there's a strong possibility they will have chosen somebody by the end of the summer, by the end of August. And knowing Neil, because I know Neil from other projects, Neil Moritz, I believe it to a certain extent, because Neil doesn't mess around. You know, when he has a project, he gets it made, you know, like, and he's, that's what he's really working hard to do right now. So once that happens, once they choose a director, it'll be a game changer, because basically, even though a script has been written, you know, what will probably happen, he often does, is the director will come in and just do their own rewrites. Which I'm kind of hoping they do, because this, in my opinion, the script is not faithful to the book. I think there are parts of it on a conceptual level that have, you know, that share sort of similarities with the book, but in my opinion, it's too different.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like if you've read the book and you see the movie, I think the experience will be too different. You know, and I'm not a fan of that. As a person who loves, you know, like reading a book and then seeing the movie, although we can all agree, oftentimes it's a very disappointing process.
Yeah.
You know, but like, for instance, Fight Club, you know, I loved the book and I loved the movie. I maybe like the movie even more. But they're in step with each other. I mean, definitely David Fincher took a few liberties here and there, but I didn't feel alienated from the book when I saw the movie.
Sure.
And so what I told the studio, and I told, you know, they asked my opinion, even though my opinion probably doesn't really matter that much, which is odd, right? So, when I've expressed my opinion, I've just said, you know, I'd really love for this to be a lot closer to the book, because, you know, that's kind of the point of doing this, right? You know, if you guys really do love the book and you're motivated to make the movie, why don't we make it a lot more like the book? Which is really not that difficult to do, because I wrote the book in a three act structure. So, and I also have an outline that I've sent to them that shows the story beats and how it could be structured easily to a script. But it's the committee, so, you know, they do things the way they do them. And all I can really do is sit back and hope that that the end result is as close as possible to the book. But that's where we are in the process, is narrowing it down to a director. And once that happens, it'll kind of really open things up in terms of getting us on a faster track to production.
Great. Well, fingers crossed on the choice of a director. And we've been speaking with Shane Coon, author of Hostile Takeover, a brand new thriller novel. Go grab a copy today. And Shane, thanks for doing this interview.
Well, thanks very much for having me. I appreciate it.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.